So I think we're going to go a little bit full circle, and I think we're going to end up at the end of this panel today, I think coming back to the same place with all of us. But I am going to throw some statistics at you initially, because that's sort of my world, and I am still working with them and trying to figure out how to balance it all. So this is my life, inspiring thoughts from stroke survivors. We're going to talk about patient narratives in the DESERVE intervention, and I'd like to thank my colleagues, Veronica Perez, David Hoffman, Eric Keith, and Lee Quarles, who all should be up here actually giving this. I have no disclosures. So first, stroke is actually a major global public health concern. It's the third leading cause of death in the United States and the leading cause of disability in the U.S. Each year here, 800,000 people will have strokes. They're not all old. Strokes occur in every age, and they continue really to have a disproportionate impact on mortality for African Americans and Latinos compared to whites. I think while much of the emphasis in stroke has really been on severe strokes, recent studies have demonstrated, and this is really important, that mild strokes and something called TIAs, transient ischemic attacks, people have these small strokes and then their deficits resolve, they have a very high risk of having a recurrent stroke event. And that means that if you have a stroke, even a mild one or a TIA, there's 30% of all people will have another event, which is typically more devastating and even potentially leading to death within the first year after that event. And so this is really a huge problem. And so when we think about trying to develop prevention strategies, and we can think about prevention in a number of ways, the first thing we really have to ask ourselves is, what areas do we target in terms of behavior change science? Are we talking about the acquisition and prevention of behaviors? Are we talking about changing existing behaviors, maintaining good behaviors? And then what is the level of change? Are we looking at focusing on change in the individual or change in the population? And then for stroke in particular, and I'm going to say stroke and cardiovascular disease, because stroke shares a lot of the same risk factors and health behaviors as things like heart attacks, heart disease, and even now we're beginning to even stretch that into non-communicable disease. And so a lot of the risk factors are also shared with some of the cancers like breast cancer. And so, but for stroke, we're thinking about then what kind of behavior types can we target? And so in stroke, we have really two kinds of overall behaviors. We have a preparedness behavior. Did you know that you could prepare for a stroke? That means that if you are having a stroke, you would know that you're having it, or you would know that somebody else is having it. And the preparedness for a stroke is recognizing the symptoms and getting to an emergency room, you know, quickly learning how to call 911. And the key thing about this kind of behavior is that it actually requires short-term skills and reinforcement. And then you have prevention, secondary, primary prevention, and you're talking about the modification of these lifestyle behaviors. You're talking about adherence strategies. And what you're really talking about is actions that require continual focus over a long period of time. So secondary stroke prevention strategies have not at all been optimal in underserved communities, and really especially among minority populations. And we believe that's likely due to the fact that unique social, cultural, and behavioral factors are not addressed in standard prevention modalities. And the standard prevention modality is an English pamphlet, eat, don't eat fat, you know, that would be something, or take your medications, but without really thinking about the entire context or picture. We also know, and our work has actually shown, that in medically underserved populations in particular, that the transition from hospital to stroke, hospital to clinic post-stroke, is very fragmented. The people don't understand that they have to go back and see a neurologist, who would be a stroke specialist. They need to go back and see their primary care physician, that the medications that they're discharged on need to be renewed by those people. And in fact, at 6 months, 50% of people discharged from a stroke unit after having a stroke or even a mild stroke or TIA have not been back to seeing their to see their physician and are not on the medications that they're supposed to be on. And also work from our SWIFT study suggests that minority stroke populations living in urban communities are not well integrated at all into either medical or community resources post-stroke. So reintegration into community is just not happening. And so again, where our focus now, again, is the reduction of vascular risk in these chronic disease patients. We talked about long-term behavioral change. We talk about a systems change. How do we get people to be integrated into services, thinking about the use of community health workers and integration into the health system. And what I should say to you, and we're going to talk about this discharge, this deserve discharge intervention, is that we're very focused on, and we've been working with our community for years on multiple stroke projects. And so the focus is then also on health literacy, a process which obviously incorporates strategies to support comprehension, decisions, and action. And our community, when we talk about stroke in our community and modification of vascular risk factors and lifestyle change, has really focused not on the individual disease, but on more healthy behaviors that are appropriate to many diseases, and these include how to make sure that you're taking the medication that you're supposed to be taking properly, adherence, how to understand that you really are in an increased risk in a very short period of time, and there's a lot of issues with risk perception and communication, and then how to engage in that physician-patient communication where both parties are getting something out and behavior is moving forward. And so the Discharge Educational Strategies for the Reduction of Vascular Events Deserve study is then a community-based, patient-paced, multi-level behavioral discharge intervention. And so we actually target our community, which is a rich, ethnically diverse community, an urban community in Manhattan, and uses this moment, this acute stroke, having this event as the teachable moment, and focusing not on the stroke patients that have severe deficit, because those are a very different type of patient. They'll have to go to long-term rehab, but really on the mild and moderate patients, stroke TIA survivors, who have, in their own words, dodged the bullet, have a quick hospitalization, may even be discharged from the emergency room or using the emergency room and or discharge destination as a place for opportunities. And then, of course, utilizing and designing intervention with underlying theoretical constructs. And so when we think about how we can get, I've just thrown a lot of information at you, and these are the same type of information that you then, as a patient in an emergency room, are going to get. Stroke is bad. You've got to change your behaviors. It's a long-term thing. You have a 30% likelihood of showing up in an emergency room. If you're Black or Latino, your rates of recurrent stroke are 3-plus times more likely to occur than if you're white. All of these things. So how do we then begin to take a deep breath and try to develop strategies for communication that are going to, be integrated into the experience, the discharge experience, discharge to home, and really begin to have the patient and perhaps their families, their networks, rethink the whole experience and try to move towards risk behaviors that are positive. And so you think about then, the development of decision support tools and what are the kinds of qualities that these support tools need to have. So there has to be information that is accessible, that there's a vividness, there's a framing, there is a tailoring of that information, but you also have potentially lower cognitive a lower cognition because of the actual event. There may be difficulty in focusing on an analytical approach to this design of communication materials. We need to move people from, to the actual experiences, an experiential mode. We need to get a comprehension that is high. We need to get a motivation and a relative value of information. It needs to all be integrated in so that when the information is weighted, the choice is to actually move the behavior forward. And, of course, move it forward with the support of other things, because individuals are not going to move behavior forward by themselves. And so that was our dilemma in thinking about how to come up with this discharge intervention in an urban multi-ethnic community. And so we really thought about then the use of narratives in behavioral interventions. You know, and narratives are culturally based stories that really provide a venue for lessons learned and occupy a prominence as a strategy because they provide connection, coherence, meaning, sense, and a link for patients. And I think, as all of our presenters talked about before, really trying to understand the experience of patients in their own words, or experience of stroke survivors in their own words, and using their own words to move not only themselves forward, but to move other people forward. Narratives provide practical experience and can model how to apply a technical knowledge to one's real life situation. In this sense, we posit that they also impose a sense of order over chaos and really allow for reflection, appraisal, and problem solving. We had to find something that could ground this very horrible and hectic experience, and at least provide something that people could cling on to as they get discharged. And then, of course, these are stories of joy, stories of suffering, and that they appeal to people's sensibilities, and hopefully can transport people into others' experience and build then an identity, an affection for and a desire, as Green talks about, for narratives. And so how did we think about developing narratives? And so we worked with a documentary film crew, and I should just say that we've been doing stroke for the last 10 years, and so we've always been working with our stroke survivors, and I'll tell you how we've done this, but we worked initially with a documentary film crew to design interviews that would solicit narratives in each of the areas that we thought were going to be important and that our stroke support community had identified as being important. And the first event that was very important is the stroke event. And in all of our stroke support groups, when we introduce people want to talk about what happened, how it happened. Risk for secondary event. We want people to sort of understand, and do they understand, and how do they understand another event potentially happening? What it's like to talk to the doctor, what are the frustrations? How do you handle medications? Are you taking too much? How do you have that? Is your regimen too complicated? And then ways to prevent another stroke by myself, self-management, or with others. And then the goal was really to create short videos. One 12-minute video, it's a little longer, and one 5-minute video to capture both the evidence base and then sort of the local adaptive recommendations. And then we get these stories that we want to resonated with the viewers. So we recruited stroke survivors to participate from our Northern Manhattan community. The documentary film crews conducted these interviews, and they were very loosely outlined, again, following the areas that we wanted to capture in both English and Spanish. The team edited the content, mapped the stories to the goals of the intervention, and incorporated key contextual aspects of the patient's stories that make it believable and enhance the possibility of identification with the storyteller. The range of stories included high priority messages and incorporated a variety of compelling storytellers. And then we brought the storytellers and the family members back to view the final product. And there were two products. There was a product that was in Spanish product again, and then 5 and 12 minutes, and then a project that was in English, 5 and 12 minutes. I think one of the most, I think for all of our staff, emotionally charged days that we had ever had was when we actually brought the storytellers and their family members back to view that final product. Everybody cried. Nobody ate. You know, we bring a lot of food. There's always food, but everyone just cried. But this really served as a validating experience for the stroke survivors. And people were saying, see, this really did happen to me, and I really made it through. And then also helped the family members. And they said, we want as much as we can get, we want our family members to know what happened. Okay, so the DESERVE participants presented the narratives, as I said. A short version was shown prior to discharge. So the connection with the narrative is made prior to being discharged from the emergency room, and then the long version goes home with them and gets supported with a workbook and a community health worker model. I'm going to just go quickly to... All right, so I just wanted to show you what, if I can... Lee, is this going to happen? How are we going to get this? Okay, what some of these looked like.
Just remember that you're not the only one that this happened to, and you have to stay strong and fight to get better, because you can get better after stroke. As long as you do your therapy and you exercise and change your eating habits, because that's important.
Okay, and again, that was an English self-determination recovery, very culturally tailored theme that we saw among our blacks and our Caucasians. I'm going to go back to our Spanish, our Latina. And she says, the advice I would give those people that are in the hospital to do the same thing I did when I had my stroke, when I was lying on that bed, I didn't give up. I had faith that I was going to get better. You cannot surrender. You fall, but then you get up again. And then there is a God out there, and he protects us from gain and suffering, from pain and suffering. Even though I have faith in my doctors, I had faith that God would also guide my doctors. So the universal theme, so there were differences again. The Latino theme was much more spiritual. The English theme was much more self-determinism. But the universal themes, medication, medical adherence, patient-physician communication, people still stuck with all of that. I'm not going to show these. So the use of narratives then to motivate long-term behavior change. So they can be viewed over and over again, and I think that's critical. The connection is there, and people continue to embrace them. It adds an emotional memory, not just information. And so when you have to get up every day and you're not and exercise every day or try to do something difficult every day, there's this emotional connection. This person did it and they recovered. And it reinforces again patients' intrinsic motivation to make behavioral changes. Through self-efficacy, you have everything you need to change. Through self-management, take your medication, change your diet, and through support, you're not alone. Again, in DESERVE, the narratives interlink with a workbook that's patient-paced, interactive, contains skill-based modules, and also a culturally appropriate research worker. And what's interesting is that when we call patients up afterwards, and we in this patient-paced manner, we find that a large proportion of patients are initiating conversations with our healthcare workers about things like, how do I speak to my doctor? You know, what are the questions I need to ask? So narrative approaches can provide a community-placed linkage. It's one place that you can make the distinction between different populations and different culturally appropriate terms and feelings. And storytelling allows patients to identify with a story as it relates to their own lives. The act of telling one's story and to have that story documented may be an intervention in itself. In fact, we're going to go back and use some of our pilot data from our storytellers to really see what kind of influence that had on their sort of sphere of networks. And I think narratives as the only form of intervention might not be enough, or it might. I think we need further research to really make that case. Thank you very much.
Terrific. Thank you very much, Dr. Bodin Albala. Well, unfortunately, we don't have much time, but I would like to have us congratulate our panelists again for terrific presentations. And I'm left with this idea that are we in sync in communicating with the people we serve? And I think that from what you've seen in these presentations, we have good ways of trying to be that, having that synchronized, culturally relevant kind of experience. And I think that was very nicely expressed in the various presentations that we had today. Let's give a round of applause to our panelists, and I'll take three questions. I know it's right on the you know, so I'm committing heresy here, but we'll go after 12 o'clock for a couple of minutes if anyone has any questions that they would like to ask.